Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah. وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك سريع
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Saudi warplanes launch fresh airstrikes in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, leaving several casualties and material damage. An Israeli minister's visit to Morocco provokes an outcry from Palestinian factions. We have a report from Gaza. And the world reacts to a heavily mutated variant of COVID-19 discovered in South Africa, imposing travel bans to curb its spread. Welcome to your world news, coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. The Saudi-led coalition has carried out fresh airstrikes in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. Our correspondent, Abdellatif Al-Washili, says there has been an unknown number of casualties, as well as material damage.
Saudi Arabia has been escalating its attacks on civilians on the residential areas in the capital city in Sana'a. They are pushing the Yemeni army to keep pressing ahead, to keep attacking the Saudi facilities. The Saudi planes have launched yesterday two airstrikes on Al Nahdain area. They have been almost launching airstrikes every day during the past months, and this will absolutely push the Yemeni army to respond to the Saudi attacks. It is the right of the Yemeni army to respond to the Saudi attacks, as Yemenis are depending on the army to push and to force the kingdom to stop these attacks against civilians. Most of the casualties of these attacks are only children and women. They are killing the Yemeni people for the seventh year. So I believe that the Yemeni army will be responding in the few coming days to the Saudi attacks and will be pushing the Saudi regime to stop its attacks on civilians.
Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip have expressed their anger at the Israeli Minister of Military for his visit to Morocco. They described the visit as a stab in the back of Palestinians. Ruba Shabit has more from the Gaza Strip.
Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip expressed the anger at the security pact signed between Israel and Morocco, describing it a betrayal that eroded their leverage with Israel. The agreement is part of the first official visit by Benignans to one of the Arab states that normalized ties with the regime last year, provoking wide outrage among Palestinians.
This is a stab in the back of our Palestinian cause and the Arab and Islamic nations. This visit of Benignans to Morocco gives Israel a green light to go further with the new crimes. All Palestinian factions refuse this move and totally condemn normalizing ties with Israel. We stress that no ties can give Israel any right in our land, as it will remain our enemy.
Palestinians say governments that have normalized ties with Israel do not represent their people.
This is really disappointing. Welcoming Benny Gantz in Morocco is a betrayal for Palestinians. He killed our children and launched conflicts in Gaza. Instead of welcoming him in Arab countries, he should have been held accountable for his crimes and delivered a punishment for killing our people. We call on Moroccan people to voice louder to end the ties with Israeli regime.
Meanwhile, Moroccans took to the streets in front of the parliament building in Rabat, condemning Gantz's visit to Morocco. The demonstration was suppressed by the police.
Our brothers and sisters in Morocco always support us. We don't blame the people for what their government is doing. We call on Moroccan people to protest against these ties that mainly aim at silencing Palestinians' voice and giving Israel a permission to commit more and more of crimes in the region. All Arab and Islamic nations should stand against the normalization of ties with Israel and support Palestinians in their struggle.
Morocco, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan signed agreements to normalize relations with Israel in 2020 as part of the so-called Abraham Accords, which were brokered by administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump. The recent visit of Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, to Morocco has angered Palestinians. They consider ties between Israel and Morocco as a green light to the Israeli regime to press ahead with its crimes in the region. Palestinians call on Arab nations to stop their governments from normalizing ties with Israel, calling it a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Russia criticizes the United States for threatening Iran ahead of the key talks in Vienna on parties' obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal.
The U.S. did not negotiate with the Iranians for a very long time and forgot that Iranians don't do anything under pressure. If they're under pressure, they resist.
Mikhail Ulyanov says Washington's stance against Iran is unhelpful and unwelcome. It comes after the U.S. warned it would confront Iran at the International Atomic Energy Agency over the country's alleged refusal to cooperate with the watchdog. Signatories to the nuclear deal are set to meet on Monday for the seventh round of their talks after a five-month break. Tehran says the negotiations will be focused on the removal of anti-Iran sanctions. The U.S. imposed the bans on Iran after pulling out of the accord in 2018. Political commentator Saeed Khan says Washington has lost its international credibility after its withdrawal from the 2015 nuclear deal. Here's more.
Not only the Biden administration, but the United States itself has certainly suffered quite a bit when it comes to geopolitical credibility. And we certainly saw this with the Trump administration and some of the rather drastic plans that occurred during that administration, including, if you recall, the U.S. withdrawal from the agreement, the JCPOA, which it had so strenuously tried to advocate to have enacted. That is going to create a credibility deficit for the United States moving forward when it comes to not only its allies, but its purported adversaries. To think now that whether the United States, even if they were to be able to cobble together an agreement, whether it would be willing to honor that with a future or subsequent administration. The idea that American foreign policy has become so politicized from one administration to the other is something that doesn't go unnoticed by other countries around the world. And when it comes to this idea then about whether this is really a bilateral agreement, de facto or otherwise, between the United States and Iran, I think that that illusion has now been shattered. And the idea that Russia and China now can leverage themselves in a much more forceful way to push back, and even as we've seen in the case of the Russian ambassador to the IAEA, calling the United States on what it sees as its inconsistencies, contradictions, and maybe even hypocrisies.
The Russian president has hosted the leaders of Azerbaijan and Armenia in the Black Sea resort city of Sochi. The meeting marks the first anniversary of a Russia-brokered peace deal that ended fighting in the volatile region of Nagorno-Karabakh. Marina Kortanova reports from Moscow.
A year after stopping the hot phase of the conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh, at the initiative of Vladimir Putin, complex negotiations were held in Sochi on the situation on the Armenian-Azerbaijani border. The leader of Armenia, Pashinyan, and the leader of Azerbaijan, Aliyev, attended the talks. Russia is counting on decisions to unblock transport communications in order to create conditions for the revival of Nagorno-Karabakh.
We have been together for centuries as part of a single state. We have very deep historical ties. I would not like them to collapse. On this contrary, we should strive to restore them and maintain them in the future.
Baku expects to receive a map of the minefields in the territories under their control, sign a peace treaty recognizing the territorial integrity of the country, delimit and demarcate the border, discuss the opening of a corridor to Nakhichevan and the creation of communications in the region.
Almost all of the points made in the statement were met, but the issue of transport communications remained unresolved. The topic of unblocking communications is one of the most important ones that has not been fulfilled.
Nikol Pashinyan replied that he did not agree with Aliyev's wording. Armenia wants to return its prisoners and demands the withdrawal of troops from the border territory, which it considers its own. According to him, Baku controls 41 square kilometers of the territory of the neighboring state.
You know, and we have repeatedly discussed this with you, that there is a problem of hostages and other detainees. This is a very important humanitarian issue.
Yerevan says it's not against opening communications to connect Azerbaijan with Nakhichevan, but against corridors. In this case, border and customs control points should be on the road. But then the country's sovereignty over the road is incomplete.
The issue of the Zangezur corridor is important for Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan provides access for Armenians to Karabakh via the Lachin corridor, respectively. Azerbaijan wants to get the Zangezur corridor, which provides for the normal passage of its citizens living in the Nakhichevan Autonomous Republic.
Following the meeting, the leaders made a joint statement which says that delimitation and demarcation of the border between Armenia and Azerbaijan will be carried out with the assistance of the Russian Federation at the request of the parties.
Last January in Moscow, the parties signed an agreement on the opening of transport links in the South Caucasus. But nothing has changed after almost a year. The situation has been aggravated by the recent fighting between Armenia and Azerbaijan. It will be clear in the near future whether Moscow has a chance to speed up the negotiation process. Marina Kartanova, Moscow.
Concerns are growing about a new variant of coronavirus first detected in southern Africa. Countries around the world are now restricting travel from some African nations to prevent the arrival of strain called Omicron. Australia plans to ban people who have been to 9 South African countries, including South Africa, Namibia, and Zimbabwe. Authorities say Australian citizens and their dependents departing from those countries are allowed to enter, but are required to quarantine for 2 weeks. Separately, the U.S. says it will bar entry to most travelers from 8 southern African countries. The decision will come into force Monday. The World Health Organization has voiced concern over the new COVID strain, which is believed to be a lot more transmissible.
So Omicron B11529 is named as a variant of concern because it has some concerning properties. This variant has a large number of mutations, and some of these mutations have some worrying characteristics. Right now, there are many studies that are underway. There's a lot of work that is ongoing in South Africa and in other countries to better characterize the variant itself in terms of transmissibility, in terms of severity, and any impact on our countermeasures like the use of diagnostics, therapeutics, or vaccines.
The official says the UN Health Agency is closely monitoring the new variant. She has called for adherence to social distancing and wearing masks to minimize possible exposure to the virus as scientists study its severity. The European Union's Health Organization has also warned that the new strain could pose a very high level of risk to the bloc. Infectious diseases specialist Gloria Taliani says the new COVID variant has raised concerns around the world due to properties that make it highly contagious. Stick a listen.
The variant of concern are observed very closely by WHO and other countries because they may represent really a danger for spreading of the virus and infecting many peoples without having has any real effective tool to contrast it. The reasons are mainly based on the mutations that are observed in the sequence of the virus that confer resistance to the presently employed vaccines. But the other characteristic that we are not really convinced of about this variant is the capability of spreading very efficiently all over the world. And in this case, the combination of the two characteristics would confer to the virus, to the new variant, a very dangerous characteristic itself, and will determine an alarm that really sets people being concerned.
Amid politically charged times, relations between Paris, London, and Brussels have become extremely strained. Mass drownings of refugees, fishing rights, and Brexit are all contributing to an ever-widening diplomatic rift. Rami Mazahiri has more from Paris.
Relations between France and the United Kingdom are reaching tragic new lows in the English Channel. British cargo vessels were blocked from docking in French ports, the latest escalation in what should be a minor economic dispute over fishing rights. French fishermen say their livelihoods are being manipulated by Paris and Brussels in order to deter another Brexit.
We really cannot go on like this. We have the feeling that we are being used as pawns and that we fishermen are the only ones impacted by this situation. We must send a signal to this French government that we cannot stay in this posture of waiting instead of acting.
Another surprising row has erupted following the recent drowning of some 30 refugees off the coast of Calais, the deadliest such accident ever recorded. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson tweeted a diplomatic request calling for joint Franco-UK maritime patrols and also new immigration agreements with both France and the European Union. Paris didn't only reject these suggestions, they disinvited the UK to emergency talks on preventing more drownings as refugees continue to set sail for England.
Je suis surpris des méthodes.
I am surprised at Johnson's method of communication, which is so unserious. Leaders of nations should not communicate with each other by tweets or public letters. We should work seriously on serious questions with serious people. We will work with the United Kingdom when they decide to be serious.
Many are saying that Macron's form over function complaint over Johnson's tweet reveals that he's trying to politicize English Channel crises for election-related gains. Two far-right candidates are threatening to run away with April's presidential election, largely on immigration-related issues. Macron continues to retain a hardcore base of support of around 20% of voters. While that may be enough to put him into the second round, many wonder if he will become the nation's third consecutive one-term president. As post-Brexit Europe settles into hardened reality, issues both minor and major may become over-politicized with increasing regularity. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger, to let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately, to help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive, to let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. Oh, the most merciful.
In the limelight.
Drone whistleblower Daniel Hale is in a communications management unit, CMU, at a medium security federal prison in Marion, Illinois. He is closely monitored by the FBI and Bureau of Prisons officials so they can prevent him from further commenting on the bloodshed caused by U.S. drone strikes. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Kevin Gozzola, journalist. This article is published under the heading Pentagon Suppressed Whistleblowers Who Exposed Massacres in Syria. Stay tuned for more. Whistleblowers in the United States military exposed a strike in Syria that resulted in the massacre of around 70 women and children, according to an investigation by the New York Times. The command responsible for the strike considered a war crime may have taken place, but a report by the Office of Inspector General for the Defense Department removed this opinion. Officials in the Pentagon impeded an investigation and ensured no one would ever be held accountable for the civilian death. They also turned on one of the whistleblowers, forcing them out of their position in IG's office. What happened proves once again that going through proper channels can be a fruitless and risky career-ending effort. Lisa Ling, a former tech sergeant who worked on drone surveillance systems and is a known whistleblower, reacted. Again, the public is notified of a war crime by a brave whistleblower who was eventually forced out of their job. This is a pattern that exemplifies the need for robust whistleblower protections, especially for the intelligence community so often carved out of them. We need more light shined in these secret spaces so this doesn't happen again and again and again without the public knowing what is done in our name. As the Times reported on March 18, 2019, in the last days of the battle against Daesh in Syria, when members of the once fierce caliphate were cornered in a dirt field next to a town called Maghuz, a U.S. military drone circled high overhead, hunting for military targets. But it saw only a large crowd of women and children huddled against a riverbank. U.S. military forces launched a double-tap strike. An American F-15E attack jet dropped a 500-pound bomb. As survivors scrambled for cover, another jet dropped a 2,000-pound bomb that killed most of the survivors. A high-definition drone recorded the scene prior to the bombing. Two or three men were near a compound. Though they had rifles, neither engaged coalition forces. Women and children were observed in the area. At nearly every step, the military made moves that concealed the catastrophic strike. The death toll was downplayed, reports were delayed, sanitized, and classified, and the Times added coalition forces bulldozed the blast site. The strike was the work of a classified U.S. Special Operations unit known as Task Force 9. They were responsible for the third worst casualty event in Syria. According to the Times, an unnamed Air Force intelligence officer in the Combined Air Operations Center at Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar contacted Lieutenant Colonel Dean Corsack, who was an Air Force lawyer. They were ordered to preserve video and another evidence from the F-15E squadron and drone crew. Corsack concluded a possible war crime was committed that required an independent investigation. He noted that Task Force 9 was clearly seeking to cover up incidents like this strike by logging false entries after the fact. For example, the man had a gun. The Air Force's Office of Special Investigations was notified. However, as the Times recalled, a major refused to investigate. Civilian casualties were only investigated if there was a potential for media attention, concern with outcry from local community and government, and or concerned sensitive images may get out. In other words, if the Pentagon needed to get ahead of a potential scandal, they would investigate and craft a narrative that could tamp down outrage. But they did not believe the Maghuz strike would ever make headlines. Corsack tried once more to convince his superiors to investigate in May 2019. They still refused. So Corsack filed a hotline complaint with the IG's office in August 2019. Gene Tate, a former Navy officer who had worked for years as a civilian analyst with the Defense Intelligence Agency and the National Counterterrorism Center before moving to the Inspector General's office, told the Times, "When Corsack came to us, he wanted to make it very clear he had tried everything else first. He felt the IG hotline was the only option remaining. Roadblocks prevented Tate from having any success. He could not find the footage from the task force drone that called in the strike. U.S. Central Command CENTCOM removed the war crime finding from a report on the massacre. In January 2020, according to the Times investigation, the Deputy Inspector General refused to sign off on a memo that would have alerted authorities to the war crime. Tate did not hesitate to criticize leadership in IG's office, and by October 2020, he was forced out of the office. In May 2021, Tate contacted the Senate Armed Services Committee and sent a 10-page letter that detailed the Bowser strike. However, as of November 13th, he was still waiting for any member of the committee to call him back. To further illustrate how stunning it is that senators on the committee ignored what Tate shared, CIA officers in Syria were so alarmed by the conduct of Task Force 9 that they complained to IG's office for Defense Department. According to one former task force officer quoted by the Times, CIA officers alleged that in 10 incidents, the secretive task force hit targets knowing civilians would be killed. The New York Times shared their reporting with CENTCOM prior to publication and asked for official comment. CENTCOM acknowledged 80 people were killed but insisted the strike was justified. The bombs killed 16 fighters and 4 civilians. As for the other 60 people killed, the statement said it was not clear that they were civilians, in part because women and children in Daesh sometimes took up arms, according to CENTCOM. This is actually part of the legacy of President Barack Obama's administration. He developed a method of counting civilian casualties that would not box him in. In 2012, the Times reported all military-age males in a strike zone found dead were presumed to be combatants unless there was explicit intelligence posthumously proving them innocent. If commanding officers refuse to support an investigation into a massacre, then they never have to worry about an investigation moving deaths in the combatant column to the civilian column, which would make them look bad. On November 3rd, the Air Force released the findings of the investigation into the U.S. drone strike in Kabul on August 29th that killed Zimari Ahmadi, an aid worker and father, his 3 sons, 2 of his nephews, and 3 girls who were toddlers. They exonerated themselves. The investigation found no violation of law, including the law of war. Air Force Inspector General Sami Sai declared, "We did find execution errors combined with confirmation bias and communication breakdowns that regrettably led to civilian casualties." But Said is undoubtedly implicated in the cover-up of countless war crimes committed by Task Force 9 and various other special operations units which engage in similar bombing attacks. Meanwhile, drone whistleblower Daniel Hale is in a communications management unit, CMU, at a medium security federal prison in Marion, Illinois. He's closely monitored by the FBI and Bureau of Prisons officials so they can prevent him from further commenting on the bloodshed caused by the United States drone strikes. Commenting on how the cycle of violence with militant groups continues, Link stated, "They don't hate our way of life. They rightfully hate our way of killing. 7 innocent women and children were needlessly killed in Syria, 10 killed in Afghanistan, and plenty more we will never know about. These are human beings, and we took their lives while using sanitized words with fancy legal footwork to get away with breaking international law. It is wrong. It is terror. And I believe Americans are complicit as long as we remain silent about what is being done in our name. Link concluded, we cannot fight a war on terror with more terror.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Seven difficult years have passed since the war broke out in Syria. 7 years is by no means a short period of time, and when you review the many different incidents that took place, it feels like it has actually lasted for decades. According to international reports, by the end of 2018, the Syrian war has claimed the lives of more than 500,000 people and left 12 million others displaced. Now the conflict has entered the eighth year, and Syria is nothing like the beautiful country it once was. Perhaps this is what makes it so interesting to visit and witness its realities. Syria in 2018. The story of Syria always starts from Aleppo, which is not the capital, but the most important city in the country. This is why capturing Aleppo meant victory for both sides of the conflict. But finally, in 2016, the war in Aleppo ended, and the very last armed groups left the city. Now the main issue is returning to normal life in this old city, where only 1 million out of its previous 5 million population is left. The war for the liberation of Aleppo lasted 4 long years, but it was well worth the fight. Aleppo, the most important Syrian city, was occupied by the terrorists, and it became the symbol of resistance and victory. Now, there are many stories from Aleppo's resistance spread throughout Syria. One of the most famous stories is about the citadel of Aleppo, where the defenders of the city fought tooth and claw. The citadel of Aleppo was a symbol of the city, like a flag raised above the land. Unlike the war, which is over in most parts of Syria, the process of returning displaced people to their cities and homes has only just begun. The cities are razed to the ground, and in some places, there isn't a single building left unharmed. But the people insist on returning to their homes and hometowns. And these days, Aleppo is the biggest symbol of the people's enthusiasm to return home. These days, Syria is filled with bizarre events and situations. Here in Aleppo, people are impatiently waiting to return to their homes. But not too far away, there are people who are forced to flee from their houses. But this time, the Takfiri terrorists are not the occupiers that has decided to occupy some parts of the country under the pretext of removing the Kurdish threat. The people of this region, who were under the control of the terrorists not long ago, are now displaced by the Turkish army and its affiliated armed forces. The refugees are fleeing Tunubl and El Zahra, the two Shia towns that were besieged for 2 years. And this is another extraordinary event that is taking place in Nubl and El Zahra these days. Shia people of Nubd and El Zahra, who have just recently been liberated, are now the host of their Sunni countrymen. And this is happening in a place where they strive to portray the war as sectarian conflicts. Turkey has been on one side of the conflict in Syria all throughout the 7 years of war, just like Saudi Arabia and the United States. But when the outcome was not what they had expected, Turkey entered the battlefields to have a say in Syria's future. Turkey, under the pretext of the Kurdish threat to its borders, and the United States, under the pretext of maintaining its military bases in Jordan, entered Syria. The arrival of these new occupiers is part of the events shaping Syria these days. Homs is considered the heart of Syria. You cannot speak about the news in Syria without talking about Homs and the events which are taking place in this large province. The undeniable fact is that in the Syrian war, a portion of the people joined the armed groups and entered a war with the central government. Although the armed forces are no longer in town, their families are still living in homes among the ordinary citizens. For sure, it is merely wishful thinking to believe that they all regret their past. Many of them have lost their loved ones in this war and are filled with resentment and a desire for revenge. This fact cannot be denied in today's Syria. So when the armed groups are referred to as the armed forces instead of the opposition, their family members refuse to proceed with the interview as a sign of protest. In Syria, Christians are not a small minority. You can see them in many different parts of the country, and some towns and villages can even be found that are completely populated by Christians. One such town is the Christian town of Marde. The war in Syria was different for two groups of people compared to the rest of the country, Shias and Christians. The situation would grow worse if the terrorists could identify a place with an unmixed population of Shias or Christians. In such cases, the outcome was predictable. If the terrorists entered such towns or villages, no one would manage to escape alive. In these 7 years of war, there were so many execution squads that it was not hard to guess the outcome. This was the reason that compelled the Shias and Christians to defend their country, towns, and villages with all their might. Today, Syria is full of Christian families who have lost their loved ones for the freedom of their country, and they proudly speak about their resistance and martyrs. The Syrian war was not a religious one, but attempts were made from the very beginning to find an excuse to create tensions between the world's Muslims and the central government of Syria. However, reality was something different. For example, many of the people of Hama, an almost unmixed population of Sunnis, refused to accompany the armed groups and did not fight against the government. Now that the war is over and the dust has settled, the truth about the lies that were broadcast to the world about Syria can be revealed. For example, the story of the use of chemical weapons against the people of Douma and the footage of the boy who was claimed to be one of the victims of the attack.
The story dominates.
It was claimed that the Syrian army had used chemical weapons in Douma, after which the United States, the United Kingdom, and France attacked the country to punish the Syrian army. But in fact, they targeted some areas that they had planned before and were just waiting for an excuse to launch their attacks. These days in Syria, many of the events that took place during the war are being re-examined in retrospect, especially by the youth in Syria, people such as Muhammad Ali. After 7 years, the events of the war can be put together like different pieces of a puzzle. For example, why did the events in Douma escalate? And why was it used against the central government of Syria? When the Syrian government decided to put an end to the mortar attacks fired from Ghouta into Damascus, suddenly the story of Douma was made into media frenzy. Ghouta was the prestige of the armed forces in Syria. It was the only place in the Arab country which was close to Damascus and was still in the hands of the terrorists for these 7 years. And especially the Saudi-affiliated groups were threatening Damascus from there. These days in Syria, the exchange of arms and the transfer of armed forces is a reality. For the government and the resistance forces, even one less casualty is considered a victory, because these killings nurture the feelings of resentment and revenge across the generations in Syria. For this reason, in the Battle of Ghouta, when it became clear that the struggle of the armed forces would lead nowhere and they would all die if they kept fighting, the armed groups were allowed to leave the battlefield. With the liberation of Eastern Ghouta, the people of Damascus can live in peace after 7 long years. Before this, the armed forces would attack Damascus with mortars anytime they wished, killing the loved ones of families. A case in point is the tragedy that happened recently to martyr Mohammad Reza Shami. Syria in 2018 is a land of both sadness and joy. Joy because of the recapture and liberation of many regions across the country, and sadness due to the loss of so many loved ones and sheer amount of destruction and devastation. The Syrian people fought tooth and claw for their country, and Iran and the resistance fighters were with them. Now finally, after 7 years, the story of Syria and its war is coming to an end. The armed groups expected that it would end, but the story of Syria's war has a different ending. It ends with the last terrorists exiting the region. Damascus stands proudly, like many other cities, even those that were under occupation someday. But the scarred soul and bruised body of the nation needs time and care to heal.
In the limelight.
Watchdogs and ex-prosecutors have strongly criticized the U.S. Republican Attorney General's Association's $150,000 donation. We present you an article written by Peter Stone. Under the heading, Group 6 of January donation shows Trump's grip on attorneys general. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. A key group of Republican attorney generals that donated $150,000 to co-sponsor the 6th of January rally, where former U.S. President Donald Trump pushed his false claims of election fraud before the Capitol attack, could draw scrutiny from a House committee investigating the events on or in the lead-up to the riot. The group, a part of the Republican Attorneys General Association, called the Rule of Law Defense Fund, has attracted strong criticism from watchdogs and ex-prosecutors, even as the Republican Attorneys General Association looks forward to next year's midterm elections and many of its members are fighting on numerous fronts against Joe Biden's agenda. The controversy around the Republican Attorneys General Association appears to be yet another way that Donald Trump and his supporters have increased their grip on more mainstream elements of the Republican Party and involved them in efforts to further their agenda. The Rule of Law Defense Fund, the policy arm of the Republican Attorneys General Association, ponied up $150,000 for the 6th of January rally and arranged robocalls that day before informing people that we will march to the Capitol and tell Congress to stop the steal. A message that was probably reinforced by Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, who told Trump's rally, "We will not quit fighting." Watchdog criticism of the RAGA policy arm that backed that rally stresses that the group's funding and robocalls occurred after dozens of court rulings rejected Donald Trump's claims of election fraud. They say it undermines respect for the nation's laws, as well as departing from the group's main focus of helping get Republican attorneys general elected. Further, the rally funding and robocalls by the Rule of Law Defense Fund sparked resignations of high-level officials, including the Republican Attorneys General Association chairman, the Georgia Attorney General, who broached concern about the group's direction when he stepped down. Controversies about Republican Attorney General's Association's rally activities come as the group has received a hefty $5.5 million from the Dark Money Concord Fund since the start of 2020, which can help Republican Attorneys General in the 2022 midterm elections. And as many Republican Attorney General, including Paxton, have filed lawsuits to thwart Joe Biden's energy, immigration, and vaccine policies. The $150,000 check that the Rule of Law Defense Fund donated to the rally came from the public supermarket heir Julie Jenkins Spancelli, funds that ProPublica reported were arranged by the Republican fundraiser Caroline Wren, a VIP advisor to the rally who has been subpoenaed by the House committee investigating the 6th of January Capitol attack. Asked about the scrutiny of the Republican Attorneys General Association and its big donation for the rally, a House Select Committee spokesperson told The Guardian that it is seeking information about a number of events that took place in the lead-up to the 6th of January attack, including details about who planned, who coordinated, who paid, or receive funds relating to those events. Some watchdog groups deplore the Republican Attorneys General Association's role in the rally. Austin Evers, the executive director of American Oversight, said in a statement, "It was clear before 6th of January that the planned rally was based on lies, partisanship, and disrespect for the rule of law." Austin Evers said that's what the Republican Attorneys General Association and its corporate sponsors chose to fund. The fact that the rally turned into a violent assault on democracy itself makes Republican Attorney General Association's involvement worse. The Republican Attorney General's Association and its funders should be held accountable. Likewise, some ex-prosecutors expressed strong concerns about the message that the robocalls by the Republican Attorney General Association's political arm conveyed. Paul Peltier, a former acting chief of the fraud section of the department at the Department of Justice, said, "Attorney General are supposed to support adherence to the law," adding, "By the time of the rally, every court in the country had affirmed the lawfulness of the election result and had specifically rejected charges of election fraud. At that stage, it seems, the Republican Attorney General Association, by urging protesters to stop the steal, was simply promoting an unlawful attack on our democracy, the antithesis of their mission." Republican Attorney General Association's then-executive director, who resigned soon after the Capitol attack, denounced the violence by the mob, which resulted in several deaths and more than 140 injured police officers, and in a sweeping denial, stated that neither the Republican Attorney General Association nor the Rule of Law Defense Fund had any involvement in the planning, sponsoring, or the organization of the protests. But campaign finance watchdogs don't buy the Republican Attorney General Association's denial. Sheila Krumholtz, the executive director of Open Secrets, said, "The Republican Attorney General Association's policy arm and other groups helped organize a rally that preceded a riot and an attack on democracy. The fallout at the Republican Attorney General Association over his 6th of January role increased in April when Chris Carr, the Georgia Attorney General, who chaired the overall group, announced suddenly he was stepping down as chairman and noted a significant difference of opinion about the Republican Attorney General Association's direction in a resignation letter. Later in April, the Republican Attorney General's Association announced that Peter Bisbee, who had overseen the Rule of Law Defense Fund when the robocalls occurred, was being promoted to become the Republican Attorney General Association's executive director. Since Joe Biden took office, many members of the Republican Attorney General Association, including Paxton and others from Missouri and Louisiana, have filed a wave of lawsuits to block several Biden priorities. The surge of lawsuits is seen as potentially helpful in the run-up to the 2022 campaigns, when 30 Republican and Democratic Attorneys General will be running for re-election after serving four-year terms. In the 2020 elections, the Republican Attorney General Association for the first time targeted incumbent Democratic Attorneys General with advertisements, and many tried to oust Democratic Attorneys General who were key Biden allies last year in states such as Pennsylvania and Michigan, where Donald Trump and his allies pushed false claims of election fraud. While the Republican Attorney General's Association this year witnessed some corporate backers hold back checks after 6th of January, its fundraising was bolstered when it pulled its $2.5 million, by far its largest contribution, and more than a third of the total raised for the first half of 2021 from the dark money Concord Fund, which the Federalist Society executive Leonard Leo helped create. The Republican Attorney General Association also received $3 million in 2020 from the same Concord Fund. The Republican Attorney General's Association roped in low six-figure checks in 2021 from oil and gas giants like Koch Industries and the Anschutz Corp and the Koch-backed Americans for Prosperity. Over the years, the Republican Attorney General's Association has garnered financial support from industries including fossil fuels and pharmaceuticals, which GOP Attorney Generals have backed in major litigation. Donald Trump himself is slated to host a fundraiser next month in his Mar-a-Lago club for Paxton, which appears to underscore his gratitude and the tough re-election campaign the former RAGA chairman is facing as three Republican challengers to him have emerged. Those opponents are focusing on Paxton's legal problems. He was indicted on securities fraud 6 years ago, and the FBI reportedly has been investigating charges of bribery and other misconduct by Paxton. Last fall, some of Paxton's former deputies accused him of improperly helping an Austin real estate developer and donor, prompting more FBI scrutiny. Paxton, who has not been charged, has broadly denied any wrongdoing. Paxton's office this August released an unsigned 374-page report rebutting the charges of former aides and claiming he was exonerated, but attorneys for the ex-employees responded to the report by saying that it was full of half-truths, outright lies, and glaring omissions.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.